let grace speak truth. Restart. This is the kingdom.
You're listening to the AND Campaign's Church Politics Podcast, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be progressive or conservative. We're trying to be faithful Christians in the public square.
This is the kingdom. The kingdom. Yes, it is. Gotta spread the word.
With your no good AND camp, you're listening to the AND Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, that's me, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, my play cousin, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Okay, I know this is becoming a pattern. This is happening again and again because he's campaigning, man. He's trying to get into civic leadership. And so Chris is not here again today. I'm sure he's on the campaign trail. I'm sure he's out working hard. So again, Cy, y'all just have to deal with me and my monologues today. But hopefully, you know, it'll be a conversation that folks feel they need to hear. You know how we usually do this. Me and Chris go back and forth. And since we talk about some pretty sad, serious and sobering topics on this podcast, we usually try to start the podcast off, or at least the episode off, on a lighter note. But I have to say, given the atrocity that occurred this week, given what happened, it's more appropriate for us to be kind of in a posture of mourning, reflection, and even condemnation of this very evil act of domestic terrorism. You know what I'm talking about. I'm sure you've already heard over and over again that 10 people were killed in Buffalo, New York, in a supermarket by an 18-year-old white man who apparently planned this mass murder in his bedroom for 3 months or so. And then as it was happening, he was live streaming it on social media. That's right, live streaming it. How evil and demented can you get with some of this stuff? He was targeting Black people purposefully. In June of 2021, we find out that he was hospitalized and given a mental evaluation after threatening his classmates that there was reason to think that he would be violent, that he could do something like this. I think he even said some things to people around him that he was interested in this kind of violence. And yet he gets a gun. And he slips through the cracks to do what was done this weekend. He was also posting white supremacist content on social media. And he subscribed to a particular conspiracy theory that we will get into in a minute. We got to talk about this. The church. People need to see the church respond to this. People need to see the church respond to this in the appropriate way. Not by trying to make sure that our tribe can evade all criticism and evade all just negativity pointed at us. It's not about us looking good coming out of this or us separating ourselves from something. It's about dealing with it in the right way. Because this is yet another sad moment in America where racialized violence has once again shown up and shown us that we are far from completely escaping our past. And if the church doesn't step up to talk about this in a constructive way, to talk about this in an honest way, to talk about this in a way where we can find healing and restoration, then I don't see how it gets resolved. But before we get all the way into it, as usual, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, the Fetzer Institute, for supporting us in what we do and how we do it. That partnership is going well. Our Christian Civic Leadership Academy is going well. And so we are thankful for that. But let's get into it. As always, grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but like a Christian. That's what we do on this podcast. Psalm 84, verses 5-7 says this. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage, As they pass through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. People, I'd like to start this segment off with a question. And the question is this. Well, a few questions, actually. And here they are. And I want you to think about it, honestly. Where do you find your strength? Is it in majority status? Is it in keeping the upper hand culturally? Being able to dictate the terms of engagement with other brothers and sisters? Or do you find your strength in the Lord? In the mercy and promises of our Father God? Are you able to walk through the valley, to endure hardship and make it a place of springs? Can you walk through the valley and have the faith to make it fruitful? Or do you resort to the dark arts, to bearing false witness to protect yourself and put your tribe in the best light, or even to violence? Is your ultimate reward in the worldly domination of other image bearers? Or does your ultimate reward transcend the power struggles and culture wars of the moment, of this world in general? Again, I want everybody to take some time to think about those questions. Where do you draw your strength? And if you don't feel like you or your tribe is powerful, where do you think you would derive strength? And what would strength look like if you were? Is it all about an exchange of power? Is it all about maintaining power? Or does your strength come from him? You see, the young man who murdered 10 people in Buffalo wrote a 180-page document, much of it plagiarized, where he expressed his white supremacist views and embraced what's called the Great Replacement conspiracy theory. It's also been called by some white replacement theory or white genocide theory. This conspiracy theory says that Black and Latino people are being brought to the U.S. pursuant to a cultural and political agenda to replace white people. You hear a lot of this coming from kind of anti-immigration groups and obviously white supremacists. They're saying that it will lead, this replacement will lead to the extinction. Yes, the extinction of the white race. Seems like quite a leap, doesn't it? Now, to place this within context, because there's kernels of truth in the context that's being set. We know that white birth rates are dropping. Our borders are somewhat porous. And the U.S. Census Bureau projects that the U.S. population will be majority minority between 2040 and 2050. Now, I don't think we need to deny those facts. That's the reality of the situation. But the question that we must ask with those facts is, what ideology, what biases, what prejudices make a more diverse America a bad thing? From what perspective, from what worldview does that diversity become something negative? What do certain people see themselves losing under those circumstances? In order to embrace the Great Replacement or white genocide theory, you have to basically equate white people not being in the majority to America losing something, to America losing its essence, or losing, for some Christian nationalists, losing the Israel promised land status. You also basically have to equate this demographic change or demographic transition to genocide. Now, I want to be very clear. As with most conspiracy theories, there are people who take it further than others. Right. So some people don't take it and wouldn't necessarily call it a genocide, but the more extreme would say that it's an elimination, some type of genocide of white people in America. That way of thinking is clearly distorted and dangerous, and it shouldn't be hard for us to see how it leads to what happened in Buffalo. It's the fruit of white supremacy. This is xenophobia and America's homegrown brand of racism in application. And it's not the first time that it's happened, but we all should be working to make sure that it's the last time that something like this happens, in as far as it's up to us. To fear others so much that you choose to become a domestic terrorist to prevent what's inevitable from happening is sick. Could there be some mental illness there? Perhaps. I'm not a doctor. I don't know. But if we use the mental illness to look over the white supremacy, to look over the statement that this young man made in his own words and some of the words of others about why he was doing that, we can talk about that later. We can factor it into the conversation, but we should not do that at the expense of looking at the role that white supremacy had to play in this conversation. Now, I'll be the first to admit that the conversation about white supremacy is interesting in America. It needs to be had because it does exist. It is real. But I'd be lying to you to say that in some circles, it's not overused. That in some circles, it's taken to create other conspiracy theories that are a little bit too much. That in some circles, white supremacy is made to be omnipotent, all-powerful, and omnipresent. That it's everywhere, just in the air, everywhere. I, because of my faith, don't believe that. I believe that it's very serious and that it needs to be dealt with in our society, but I'll never say that it's omnipotent or omnipresent. That's just me. But to get back to the initial question that I was asking, or one of the questions that I was asking, why is the demographic shift such a threat to some people? It shouldn't be seen as a negative unless you attach some greater value or some greater potential to being white. Unless being ontologically white is superior or more desirable than other races. If that's not the case, then this shouldn't seem to us like an existential threat. But inevitably, this, for some, is really about losing power. It's about no longer being able to impose your will on others. That's what seems to me to be at the heart of this incident, based on that theory and based on this manifesto that we saw coming from this young man and or what we have of it. Now, how widespread is this particular conspiracy theory? I'm not sure. I don't want to go too far into speculating about that. But the fear of losing power is widespread. The fear of losing power even rears its ugly head in the American church, internally within the church. You can see it in the way that some majority Christians romanticize American history, as if they'll lose something if they allow the truth to get out about how America in the past has failed miserably, committed genocide, and we know all about slavery in the name of white supremacy, of maintaining power. You can see it in some and how some do everything in their power to maintain majority culture in the church as if it's synonymous with church culture or the superior culture within the church. We see it in how some church leaders and just believers in general view everything that doesn't come from majority Christians as automatically suspicious. There are some people in the church that if a message or if something important comes from anywhere other than a majority Christian or the majority church, it is automatically viewed with a hermeneutic of suspicion. Why is that? Where does it come from? We've talked about during imperialism and colonization, the thought was that only intelligence and civilization could come from the West. And I think we see some of the seeds of that in the majority church, in that true orthodoxy, true biblical thought only comes from one space. And if it comes from somewhere other than that, then it's very suspicious. Therefore, in some circles, you see Black people are expected to jump through all kinds of hoops and give all kinds of explanations to prove their orthodoxy. Stating their orthodoxy and upholding the authority of Scripture sometimes isn't enough. You got to do more to prove to us that you're actually orthodox. We need to think about where that comes from. We need to think about how Christians are hanging on to power more than they're hanging on to the promises of God. Do we fear that in losing power, we lose more than what we have in our inheritance that goes beyond that? These are questions that folks have to ask. And one of my mentors, Dr. Barbara Williams Skinner, urged me yesterday to speak directly to white leaders. And so I'm going to do my best to do that right now. White Christian leaders need to speak up against the ideology and the spirit behind the great replacement theory, which is really the same ideology and spirit that's behind the shooting. And it needs to be done directly and in no uncertain terms. You cannot allow that mentality to reside in any form in your church, whether it's homicidal or more subtle. It is still dangerous. And it's been killing people throughout this country's history. And as we see, it's still killing people today. We don't have the convenience of ignoring it and pointing at other things and trying to absolve ourselves. We need to deal with it with truth and with sincerity and with grace. Let's not respond. And then this is the other part. So I wanted to speak directly to white Christian leaders on that point. Please have something to say about this. I'm not going to tell you exactly what to put in your sermon next week or anything like that. But at some point, have something to say directly about this issue and urge and challenge Christians to understand that your strength inevitably has to come from him, not from your cultural power or your power within society. That's my challenge to you. Now, here's my challenge to others, because I rarely challenge one side and not the other. And this is not to say that there's some, you know, equal amount of blame or anything like that. But we all are called and challenged to do something in this circumstance, in circumstances like this. Let's not respond to the great replacement conspiracy theory with our own unfounded conspiracy theories, or what we might call excessive speculation that usually fits our choice narrative perfectly. I really get upset when people use crime in urban communities as a prop to turn our focus away from the racist roots of atrocities like this. Do not talk about these statistics in some of our cities when we really need to deal with this. Don't use that as a prop to distract people and to change the conversation. That's not right. But at the same time, let us not use these situations to avoid talking about what's going on in urban communities. Can we separate them and have two real conversations at the same time without both sides trying to use the other to avoid talking about things that might be in their sphere of influence? We've got to be able to have those conversations in an honest way and in a humble way. If within these conversations about racial violence, we're more concerned about protecting our narrative, we're more concerned about escaping the conversation without anybody thinking that we've ever done anything wrong throughout history, within our tribe, within our country, within the majority church or any other church, then we're not going to get to what we need to get to, which is the truth and to solutions and to redemption. If we're going to be peacemakers, if we're going to heal and restore, we've got to face the truth and deal with the truth and not be worried about our reputations or worried about what somebody might have to say about us. It's bigger than us. It's bigger than our culture. And we have to deal with it with truth and love. I'll be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. I'm back on the Church Politics Podcast. In July of 1964, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had this to say about Republican presidential nominee Barry Goldwater. He said this: I feel that the prospect of Senator Goldwater being president of the United States so threatens the health, morality, and survival of our nation that I cannot in good conscience fail to take a stand against what he represents. Mr. Goldwater articulates a philosophy which gives aid and comfort to racists. When Donald Trump was running for office, when he was elected, many African Americans and others expressed the same sentiment or a similar sentiment as Dr. King did when he was addressing Barry Goldwater. That he articulates a philosophy, or he articulates a point of view that gives aid and comfort to racists. You can look so far as how he talked about immigrants. You can look at who he courted, right? That there was a courting of certain groups who had racial animus, and never any attempt to check them on that, to separate himself from groups that you shouldn't want to feel okay or feel any comfort with you. They shouldn't feel like they could land or have a home in your coalition. But you just didn't see that pushback. And over again, people of color, people in the church said, this is a huge problem, a problem that most people didn't have with a lot of the other Republican candidates at the time. Not to say that none of them had any issues, but it wasn't the same. There wasn't that same courtship. And now we have this atrocity. Now we have what happened in Buffalo. And I want to be very clear. I personally don't put all that blame on anybody but the person who did it. But there is a environment that's been created. There's a point of view that hasn't been pushed back on hard enough by certain people in certain parties. Representative Liz Cheney had to say this in response to what happened in Buffalo. She said, the House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far more. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them. And that's so important because you do get people who renounce those views in general, but don't want to be specific on renouncing the people who hold those views, because the people who hold those views often are in their own party, are in their coalition, are in their base. Now, I want to be very clear. Most of y'all already know this. Liz Cheney is a white Republican, right? Those are her words, not mine. But I do think that she has a point that people need to deal with. Has the Republican Party denounced and rejected those views in no uncertain terms as a whole? I know some individuals have. And have they rejected the people that hold them and say, you know what? This isn't the coalition for you. Now, those who listen to this show, those who have been listening to this show for a while and take us at our word, know that I have no true allegiance to either party. If either party imploded tomorrow, I promise you, I would not shed a tear. At very most, I'm a very lukewarm Democrat for practical reasons, but let me tell you again, and we say it over and over again, and we said it last week, my identity is not in the Democratic Party. You can criticize the Democratic Party all you want. I will not feel criticized personally. I may or may not agree with you, but I certainly won't feel anything personally because you said something about the Democrats. Again, my identity is not with that. If anything, I rock with the Solidarity Party and folks like that far more than I rock with the Democrats. But there are practical concerns that we should be paying attention to. But if you want to know why a lot of Black people don't even consider the Republican Party, this provides you with a perfect example. We give the historical example with Dr. Martin Luther King and what he had to say about Barry Goldwater. It is nothing new. We give the present example, and this isn't an indictment on every single Republican, but there are too many Republicans, especially those in leadership, who do not step up to push back against this kind of these kind of issues, who let things be said about immigrants and others and don't push back because they don't want to lose votes. And so if you're wondering why a lot of Black people don't even come near the Republican Party, that's a good place to start. And I say that with an understanding of having Black conservative and brown conservative Republican friends who I think I have a lot of respect for and who I think are very intelligent. But when you want to look at Black people and others as a whole group, these are some of the things that we have a problem with. And I want those folks who are Republicans to ask themselves, has the Republican Party historically and in present day done enough to push back against folks who hold these extreme views, or do these folks who hold these extreme views feel like they can find a home near you? Feel like they can be comfortable in your coalition? If so, they shouldn't. And again, this is not something that's new. This has been happening for a long time. When you look at the Southern Strategy, the GOP very clearly invited racists into the party because of a fear of losing power. And it hasn't stopped today. Now, if you want to talk about, you know, you're going too hard on Republicans, that's fine. Go to another episode where I go harder on the Democrats. Okay? You can find that in other episodes. But today, I'm addressing a statement made by a Republican about how the party has not pushed back enough against these kind of views. And you're happy to hit us up on the Patreon. You're happy to, you know, we're happy to have a back and forth with you about that if you can prove that wrong. But it's time to do some examination of where we are and if we're setting the right example and making clear that certain things are unacceptable within our base, within our coalitions, within anybody that you would want support from. Not blaming this on anybody but the shooter. But it's something we got to think about. I'll be right back. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND Campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics, or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND Campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction. The AND Campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. All right, we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. It's me, Justin Gibney. This has been a tough conversation because we've had a tough few days. And it's one where I think the church can stand up, and the church can do better, and the church can be more clear about where we stand on some of these issues. We've been talking about conspiracy theories. We've been talking about the loss of power. And I want to switch it up a little bit right now to talk about something that I guess deals with conspiracy theories and where they come from, but it's a different subject and probably a little bit of a different tone here. I just read an article that I thought y'all would be interested in and would advise you to go check it out yourself. Anytime that we present articles here, you'll find them in the show notes so you can check it out yourself, that you don't have to take our word for it. But this was a really good article that I saw by Alexander Stern in the New Atlantis. And it was entitled The Technocrat's Dilemma. It was talking about how expert rule is destroying itself. Expert rule is destroying itself. It starts by saying this. Public health organizations like the Center for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, as well as politicians and bureaucrats at every level, have struggled with messaging amid a climate of widespread distrust that only seems to be getting worse the more they try to fix it. And I think that is true, especially with the CDC. We saw seen them go back and forth and say something, then take it back and all this other stuff. It's been their messaging has been especially bad when we think about the pandemic and all that's gone on. And I know they don't have an easy job. So I do want to say early on, this is not easy stuff. When you're dealing with a pandemic, you want to be cautious. You want to make sure you say the right thing, but you're learning as you're speaking. You're learning as you're trying to fix something. And so it isn't easy. I do want to say that. But one of the points that Alexander Stern makes in this article, The Technocrat's Dilemma, is that we pay too little attention to the way that technocracy or the rule by scientific and managerial experts paradoxically contributes to the declining trust in science. Right. So the idea is that when we try to rule society by scientific expertise and managerial expertise, it actually leads to a declining trust in science. And one of the people he cites is a German social theorist who I will not try to pronounce his name right now, but you can go to the article and see it. But this German social scientist writes this, and he kind of writes about how the modern technocracy, so to speak, creates a barrier between scientists and politicians on the one hand and the general population on the other. So there's this separation between the two. And the upshot is a system of domination that tends to exclude practical questions from public discourse. So you get this situation where you have these experts and what they say goes, and there's no discourse between the experts and the population. They just say, hey, this is what science says. This is what you got to do. And there's no further discussion. And the politicians aren't necessarily pushing that discussion either. It goes on to say that expertise is trumpeted and deferred to, but with little attempt to understand or explain it. Experts, many progressive politicians seem to believe that public policy can and should be a technical matter for specialists. This is what Alexander Stern is saying, right? When it comes to public policy, just let the experts handle it. These specialists know what needs to happen, and that's it. And that's why we often heard people screaming, follow the science during the pandemic, which is wise in a sense, right? You don't want to ignore what scientists are saying about how this how contagious it is and how it's spreading. You do need to listen to that. But I'll say this too, the Church Politics podcast, right at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were still podcasting and trying to figure all this out, said this very clearly early on, which is people were failing to understand that science is only one factor in policymaking. You can have a scientific discovery or some scientific information, and it doesn't necessarily apply perfectly to the rest of the situation because there are other factors that are going on. And through much of the pandemic, that just wasn't being recognized by a lot of people in high places. And I think it added to what we're talking about, which is this distrust of the experts and of the science in general. And I'll be honest, when it comes to this, just trust the experts. Myself being somebody who was in the professional class, I see this among a lot of my friends in the professional class. Many times they have this frustration that's like, why don't they just do what we say? And I think without malice or anything like that, the implication is that non-professional people are being unreasonable, are being obstinate for no good reason. Why can't they understand what I said and just do what I said? But in many cases, I think the professional class really fails to acknowledge that sometimes we just haven't explained it well. that sometimes the point that you're making isn't clear or it just doesn't make sense. So you could be a scientist, you could be all type of experts, you could have all these degrees, you could have all these certifications. But if what you say doesn't make good sense, if it doesn't connect to how I understand the world works, that's problematic. The other thing I think this point of view fails to acknowledge is that our institutions have gotten some really important things really wrong in the past and have lost credibility with your average person. And so when you put your expertise out there and you make this statement and you say, hey, go follow this and do what I say, you're missing some of the factors that may cause somebody who's not unintelligent, but just may cause somebody to question what you're saying. But guess what? There is no question. There is no back and forth where they have to answer these questions. There's such a separation, and really between the experts and the people should be the politicians forcing these questions to be answered and communicating in ways that the experts might not be communicating. But too often, that just isn't happening. We're not recognizing the loss of credibility. We're not recognizing that sometimes these things just aren't explained as well as they should be. Stern goes on to point out in the article that policy quite obviously cannot itself be scientific. Let me say that again. Policy quite obviously cannot be scientific within and of itself. Science or expertise should be employed in making decisions about policy, but politicians and the experts advising them must ultimately make recommendations and decisions based on values, practical and moral commitments, and political realities and possibilities. So important. Yes, science is important. Very. But people need to understand, especially the politicians and the experts, that decisions are made based on values, practical and moral commitments, and political realities and possibilities. There are other factors that go into this conversation, and we don't help people's view of science by not taking those things into account. He goes on to say that technocrats, when they speak in public, use the rhetoric of objective, neutral, scientific knowledge to justify policy decisions that are not and cannot be fully based on science. We saw this so many times where people were saying, this is what the science said, but people could tell that there was an ideological slant, a partisan slant to what was being said, and so they didn't trust it. Not that they think science is completely unuseful, but they know when it doesn't apply in the way you say it's supposed to apply. Now, again, I want to be very clear. This is not to justify all kinds of conspiracy theories, but you got to understand that it's not just people who are caught up in conspiracy theories that don't trust what some of the experts are saying. And this you see in the backlash when it comes to schools and how schools responded. You can see this in Virginia and other places. People did not believe the response and believed there were other things behind the response other than science. And they believe that other values weren't taken into consideration. You can see this with Fauci. Don't wear a mask. Wear a mask. Masks don't work. Now they do work. Now they don't work again. What do you want people to take from that? Does that justify crazy conspiracy theories? I don't think so. But can you blame people for having some level of distrust? Again, look at the CDC back and forth on so many issues. Putting something out, then taking it back based on what they're saying is science, but it looks like there's partisan ideological thing going on at play behind that. So really good article, something we all have to wrestle with, because I don't want you to leave you here. And if anybody who listens to this knows that we think science is helpful, we don't see a conflict between science and Christianity. We think science is one of the ways that God helps us understand his general revelation. Science is good, but it's not everything. And just because you call yourself an expert doesn't mean you don't have it to explain yourself. Doesn't mean that you're somehow above the public discourse, that you don't have to go back and forth and ask hard questions to make things make sense. You can't just make a statement and expect everybody to go along with it. And that's one thing the professional and expert class has to start to understand. Well, I know we had some tough conversations, or I had some tough monologue, maybe that's the best way to put it, on this episode. I want everybody to be praying for the families of the folks who lost their lives in Buffalo. I also want you to pray for the perpetrator, because his life is not over. He can be redeemed, but he has done a terrible, terrible thing. And it's time for the church to step up and dismantle the ideology and the spirit that leads to things like this. Again, we're not blaming anybody for this, but there are things we can do to put our society in a better situation, and we need to do that. All right, folks, as usual, Ann Camp, there is a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp, I'll holler at you. Kingdom. Oh, Lord, I say kingdom.